Hello, welcome again to Sport Unlock. Coming up, new claims around Chelsea's Weber finances in the Abramovich era, discrimination in World Cup host nations, and shining a light on our own industry. Our media coverage priorities right, and when is outrage overblown? All of that and more to discuss. Joining me, Rob Harris from Sky News as ever, Tarek Panja from the New York Times, and double award winner, Martin Ziegler from the Times.
Thanks very much, Martin. Yeah, very kind of you. Very pleased to get those awards. But Rob, I think you'd set a new record by being shortlisted for no fewer than four awards, which is quite some going.
Shortlisted for four, no trophies, only getting up to present some awards, but not being able to present you with your Sports Reporter of the Year and Scoop of the Year at the Sports Journalists Association.
Ziggs, you're a handy man, I hear. So have you started building that extra tier on your shelf for these trophies? Because it's getting pretty full there.
Well, it's I think it's more sort of trying to dig the old ones out of the attic, actually, because, they don't hang around for long, that's for sure.
A good night of celebrations. And, of course, it's straight back to work immediately, even the start of the week. Nottingham Forest there. Appeal against the Premier League's financial ruling, something also we'll get into this week. I actually spent some time with a real footballer, not a football politician, Jude Bellingham.
What was he like?
You often have to sort of remember he's only 20 years old, so level-headed, so calm, really engaging. You can often tell, as you know, you've been with footballers around in the past, when someone doesn't want to be there or when you're having a small talk before and after an interview. And certainly he was someone who wanted to have a chat and, you know, some stuff that wasn't in the interview, some weightier matters.
Do you get a sense that the current generation are more prepared for the media than maybe in the past? Because what you're describing reminds me a little bit, like in the US, where the athletes are going through, say, NBA or NFL, and they're almost trained just as much to deal with the media as they are to do, you know, to practice what they're brilliant at.
Yeah, I remember when he had his unveiling press conference at Real Madrid, it was the journalist, I think, Sid Lowe in the audience, that when he asked a question, Bellingham said, listen to your podcast. So you certainly get a sense of someone who's rounded and listening into the game. The fact he went to Germany during the pandemic, he talked to me about that and that growing experience that he's there out in Germany, and someone who clearly likes to sort of be engaged, someone who's certainly worldly, you'd get a sense of, and so important for Real Madrid already, made such an impact, probably one of the toughest environments, and quite a bit of our conversation was his experience growing up, watching the pain of England at past tournaments, being embarrassed, and, you know, certainly someone who seems to be in the right frame of mind to have a very long career, potentially.
He's a podcast fan, it seems like.
Not our podcast yet, but maybe things will change.
I can say that someone at the school where I went to see him, where he was working around an initiative, is a pod listener.
Oh, very good. Welcome.
From Tiny
Acorns. To them.
Yeah, someone who's doing some work in and around Bellingham. The project was actually helping to sort of encourage more coaches into the game, particularly for those with disabilities. So, you know, certainly good to spend some time with him. I was also in Cardiff this week. That was the night before for the Wales-Poland Euros qualifier.
That must have been an experience, Rob. I mean, I remember doing the Wales-Russia qualifier where it was massive disappointment where they lost out there. So I guess it must have been similar sort of atmosphere after the penalty defeat there.
Well, I actually had to go outside before the penalty so I could be live on air as we had the result, which meant, just by how it timed, I was actually on air as the shootout was underway, and it concluded while I was still on my time on air and had to break it by catching a glimpse of the result being fed into me on my phone.
So hopefully you had a stony face and that you're... How do you... Actually, it's a good question, Rob. How do you prepare yourself? Because it could have gone one of two massive ways emotionally, right? It would have been either this huge night of glory and happiness or, you know, real low, which it turned out to be. How do you prepare yourself in that moment for that?
Well, as I'm about to go on air, I haven't a clue what I'm going to be saying in the next sort of minute or so, because you don't know what's going to happen. From a UK perspective, less of a story, the fact Wales then didn't qualify, the fact Poland winning that shootout. And I was also on air talking about some of the wider significance of the results early in the night when we had those previous results, because We also had Georgia qualifying and Ukraine winning their playoff final as well. And as Graham Dunbar from the AP pointed out on Twitter, Russia broke the Olympic truce three times since 2008, with aggressions first in Georgia and twice in Ukraine. Two of these countries are going to Euro 2024, and one of them was banned from it.
Yeah, Russia obviously haven't been welcome in international sport broadly for such a long time. And more news from Russia. There was the game between Russia and Paraguay, which would have been, I think, the first big international, even though it was a friendly country, to go to Russia to play a game there. That got called off, didn't it? And they're blaming the terror attack on the Crocus Hall there, the shooting attack a few days earlier. Do we know any more about that?
Yeah, the Russian Football Union saying that the friendly has been postponed indefinitely as they mourn those killed, more than 130 people killed after the gunman opened fire there at that venue. Not the only game to be called off in the last week as well. North Korea cancelling its World Cup qualifier against Japan. A renewed focus actually on some of the challenges in terms of North Korea's participation in world football. As for the Euros playoffs, Israel also knocked out, losing to Iceland, so failing to qualify for a first tournament since the 1970 World Cup. So it does reduce the security challenges for Germany at those Euros, while, of course, obviously shocking, we have to even consider it within that context.
Yeah, I think both the Germans' security people and UEFA had been sort of keeping a close eye on what was going to happen with both Israel and Ukraine, actually, because obviously there are security challenges with both. So I suppose that's one less thing for them to focus on. But Ukraine obviously is going to be an issue, security-wise.
Well, it'd be interesting to see if there's actually a lot of widespread support for Ukraine, given that, you know, the sense of things, particularly in Western Europe. So there might be quite a bit of solidarity, you might expect.
Yeah, also, I think they'll have a significant number of travelling fans, you know, in terms of the diaspora that has left Ukraine since the war. There's a lot in Germany, particularly in Poland, in Britain as well, Ireland. So I think they will have quite a strong support there. And it will be, I guess, a chance to not only support the football team, but highlight the plight of their nation. It would be interesting to see how that plays out.
In other UEFA news of the former vice president, Luis Rubiales, the case continues. We talked about a different strand of investigations into him last week over Spanish Federation dealings with Saudi Arabia. But now it is back on the case regarding that alleged non-consensual kiss on Jenny Hermoso at the World Cup final.
Yeah, I think it's the prosecutor is recommending a total of 2.5 years. So that would be for the two charges. One is sexual assault, the other is coercion. We should say Rubiales denies these, going to fight them all the way. I think in Spain, if a sentence is less than 2 years, that's effectively suspended. So we've seen before with footballers who've been jailed for tax offences, they've not actually served any time behind bars. So that's something to keep an eye on as well.
Rubiales in part did resign from the federation to protect the men's 2030 World Cup bid. Six nations, three continents, that's turned out to be, with Spain the focal point. But yet again this week, attention on just how welcoming Spain is as an environment for footballers. A powerful moment this week before Brazil's friendly against Spain at the Bernabeu Stadium, when Vinicius Junior spoke about the constant racism he's suffering playing for Real Madrid. And he's talked about the many official complaints, but no one has ever punished. He said, it's exhausting because you feel like you are alone.
Yeah, the words obviously were strong, but if you were to see the press conference, you know, the fact that this is one of the most famous people in the world, one of the most talented athletes, and him breaking down in tears to express this. This is how much he's feeling this. No one should have to face that going to work. And the other thing with that was his teammate, Dani Carvajal, who plays for Spain, when he was asked about it, he said Spain isn't a racist country because he's got friends of all different types of backgrounds. And he may have that. But this was a moment, I think, for Dani Carvajal to stand up for his teammate and show support to Vinicius Junior. And I think some of that was upset quite a lot of people to see those comments in the context. And he may have all of these friends. He may be a perfectly, he's a nice guy, but maybe that's not what you're supposed to say at that point.
Yeah, I thought it was a sort of very moving and very sad to see Vinicius Jr. like that. And yeah, that sort of thing, oh, Spain's not racist because, I've got some friends who are black. I mean, that's just absolute, so tone deaf, it's unbelievable by Carvajal, but there we go. I mean, this is the country whose previous Spanish FA president about 10 years ago, when he was asked about racism in Spanish football, said there was no racism at all in Spanish football, at all. And that was the end of that. That was the end of, as far as he was concerned, that was the end of the subject.
And that is the lack of confidence that is growing about Spain's ability to protect black players in particular from abuse at matches. Also this week, another World Cup host nation, this is 2026, and co-host Mexico, their fans hurling homophobic abuse at the US goalkeeper Matt Turner during the Nations League, and the game had to be stopped twice in Arlington, has been condemned by CONCACAF. Mexico being fined, according to an AFP tally, $650,000 over the years for a dozen separate instances, and they've been ordered to play games without fans during qualifiers for the 2022 World Cup. It does lead to this broader point, so that's Spain, that's Mexico, the racism in Spain, the homophobia from Mexico fans. Would some be sort of looking at the media and saying if it was a different part of the world, there'd be far greater scrutiny and questioning, should they even be allowed to host their World Cups that they're planning to?
Yeah, that's a really good point. We can also look at other issues with these countries beyond the racism. And I think the point you're making is related to that focus on Qatar, Rob, if we're honest. And maybe there is something to that, because this 12 separate cases you described in Mexico, and this is still there, yet it wasn't a consideration when it came to hosting, because Mexico, inverted commas, is a football country, I guess, and World Cup should be hosted there. But again, players shouldn't have to face this, and communities shouldn't have to face having to run the gauntlet at these stadiums every time. What do you think FIFA can do, though? I mean, you mentioned stadium bans. What comes next?
Well, I mean, they have done it, as you say, done it twice already, haven't they? They've had to play two matches, two internationals behind closed doors previously. So I don't think FIFA is taking this lightly. It's going to be one of those things. If supporters know that that's what's going to happen, you would have thought sooner or later that the penny might drop, but maybe not.
But you'd think if this was a case of fans in Qatar abusing players in some way, friendly ahead of them hosting the World Cup, there would be global demands, probably politicians getting involved, take the World Cup off them, would be getting bombarded with rights groups. Selective media outrage perhaps too, not asking every manager around games this week about issues around Spain. Are we concerned about them hosting the World Cup? Or are we concerned about Mexico?
Yeah. The other thing is, all these sanctions, the stadiums closed. Imagine, how could you be so desperate to have to say this word? Because obviously the message is out there. It makes you wonder the need, the urge of the public. Well, I really have to say this. I really have to chant this particular thing. Football culture is so broad in the Americas. There's so many interesting chants and songs. Maybe lads, might want to give this one a miss.
Yes, certainly they'll be under a lot of pressure to do so with, what, just 2 years until that World Cup in North America.
I suppose the difference between Qatar and some of the other countries we mentioned, like Mexico, is it's as abhorrent the chanting we heard in these stadiums is. Homosexuality isn't banned or outlawed in Mexico in the same way as it is in Qatar. And this is why those concerns about human rights, etc., were raised in so vociferously in Qatar. Equally, the issues around migrant workers, again, perhaps an issue that will come up as building projects take place. But, for example, the kafala system that was discussed in Qatar isn't really known outside of the Gulf countries, at least in terms of countries that are hosting the World Cup.
in England, there's been a lot of commentary around what is offensive in the last week. What is something to really use your platform for to express deep concern and outrage? And it's largely centered on the England shirt. And it seems to be amongst the most ridiculous use of commentary time ever. What happened was they put the new England shirt out with a flag of St. George, which is a red cross, and it was slightly colorized in a different way, as has happened many times when politicians have used the flag on backdrops at speeches, even the royal family too. Yet it seemed like it was the most heinous thing to ever have been done to the England shirt, and something that really was seen as the biggest offense ever, the fact that it wasn't completely red, the flag of St. George. And something that struck me was the level of commentary around this compared to another incident that happened, and he isn't particularly widely known internationally, but Stuart Webb is the former sporting director of Norwich City, and he's had quite a large media profile in England in recent years, often interviewed, so he has a certain status. And in an interview with a media outlet in Norwich, he talked about various players, including Raheem Sterling, Abu Kamara, Max Aarons, Jamal Lewis, and Jonathan Rowe, saying that they might have ended up in jail had they not become footballers, and the players, the families, very concerned.
There's been moves by the club to sort of distance themselves from that. I think his representatives have said he's sort of made a mistake and he's trying to sort of put it right with the players. But I think, you know, kick it out. Troy Townsend was absolutely infuriated and by these comments. The Sunday Times, they Jonathan Northcroft did a big story on it, so that it did get some focus, but of course nothing like the culture wars around the flag on the shirt. I think we talked about it briefly, I think, last week. It's the way of the world at this moment, and there are some people who do get upset by, you know, flags and things like that, and, you know, who think they're being patriotic and nothing can, you know, ever change a flag. But, you know, look, Scotland, the Scotland shirt, they did a similar thing with the Scottish flag on a shirt. Nobody even sort of mentioned it, and it was almost the same. But it just shows it's politicians get asked about these things, they think they have to respond in a particular way, and it just gets blown up.
It's just pathetic, though, isn't it? Well, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, the point here is this is cheap engagement, Rob. You knew you picked this thing, completely nonsensical storyline, make it a part of the culture war, get all the engagement, and, you know, our industry is part of this. Let's be honest. The Stuart Webber story was far worse because of what he said. But clearly, you'd be able to wring a week of storylines out of that. You wouldn't get all the politicians, and then you get the engagement. And to be honest, just on this, there was one story that really annoyed me. It was about the naming this fellow who worked at the FA, who apparently he's the guy who allowed this to happen. Now, if you speak to people who make shirts, it's not that the whole shirt making process design, it goes through a lot of people. It's not one bloke gets to just say, right, yep, that's good, let's make the England shirt like this. You know, and the thing that annoyed me about it is he's an Asian guy, and his big brown face was placed next to the story. And you can imagine what happened next in the comment section. And it's just cheap. It's so unnecessary. And for these people, it can be quite dangerous.
It is potentially stirring things up. We saw in the case of Stuart Webber, it is a case of racial profiling. And whether it's conscious or subconscious, it's exposing that mindset.
I looked at some of those comments under that story, and it was absolutely horrendous. I think that's what I really didn't like about the whole sort of flag on the shirt issue, is that it's sort of fueling the whole sort of social antagonism.
And it is that phrase that is used to stoke anger. We want our country back. This sort of vague dog whistle that can be viewed as very incendiary and with undertones that can whip up public discontent and hatred.
As we talked about it last week with that picture that Henry Winter posted on Twitter with the four black England players and the ridiculous comments that follow that along the lines of what you're talking about. But, you know, I'm sure we'll talk about this again at some point.
It's about how our industry does use its platform, the weight of commentary. Terry, just quickly, one point. You're concerned about one entity that's given coverage, and perhaps we shouldn't name them.
Perhaps we should or we shouldn't, Rob.
Well, would that just give them more coverage?
Exactly. Yeah, no, this group that has decided, appeared out of nowhere, to say they want to host a sporting event with doped-up athletes. It's a bloke who might have some standing in the world of finance and law, I suppose, but it's someone who hasn't really done anything in terms of hosting a sport event. He hasn't got any significant athletes signed up to this crackpot project of his. But seemingly, he's got a great public relations team because he's had so much press. Look, if this thing goes ahead, it gets covered. Let's be honest. But it's pie in the sky at this point with some, you know, retired athletes who seem to might be willing to sign up. Why is it getting so much coverage?
I don't know, actually, Tarek. I'm quite fascinated by it, actually, in a way. And I've read quite a lot about it. Because, you know, for example, is this people going to use performance-enhancing drugs to do things like, you know, break the two-hour marathon or... the extremes that can be gone to.
I agree with what you were saying. Hang on, let me ask you, Martin, though, is I don't disagree with that. Absolutely fascinating. If you juice up, you know, someone in the park to run 6 seconds, yes, it will get a lot of coverage and probably deserves to because someone has just run 6 seconds. But this guy hasn't done anything. I mean, why don't we cook this up now? Martin and Rob and Tarek, what we're going to do, we're going to have our own doped up games. Come and interview us. Like, why don't we get all this coverage as well? What has he actually done to deserve the coverage beyond saying, I'm going to do this?
Games unlocked. Unlocking your true potential by using any enhancements to achieve the maximum your body might be capable of. I don't know. Is that...
Just sounds like... branding. Just sounds like so great, so you didn't have the idea first, Tarek.
I'm no scientist, but... is there any sort of claim that you need to try and see what your body can physically achieve in the maximum circumstances for things like space exploration, things like that?
Potentially. In the military, soldiers are given lots of drugs to do things like stay awake for 7 days and things like that, aren't they? So there are reasons why people take drugs for various things, but I don't think there's any sort of justification for doing it sports-wise, other than it's a sort of it's something that I'm interested in seeing what would happen and what the effect of the drugs is, rather than celebrating their achievements.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a bit like man v beast. let's race a cheetah and see who comes first, or something like that. I think the more interesting or the most, compelling sports story right now in terms of threats to international sport is that friendship games that Russia has announced. Now that is an event which the IOC appears to be terrified of, given what it's been talking about, offering prize money to athletes, something the Olympics doesn't, and something people have said they should earn. And I think some athletes will want to be compensate and seeing that's fair. But then, Rob, the political issue with Russia being potentially the rival to the IOC.
Yeah, and something we covered quite a bit in depth on last week's podcast. You can listen back to get more discussion on that as we conclude the point on these doped up athletes. Something we said we shouldn't be talking about. We ended up getting quite into it and quite a lot to debate around. So maybe that's exactly why it is covered. But you could say that a lot of our time should be spent on the weight of investigative journalism and the strength of things that can be exposed that those in the industry don't want uncovered. And this relates to what's being reported by The Guardian with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists and Germany's Paper Trail Media. And it's a leak of documents from an accountancy firm in Cyprus. Now, they are alleged to have been working with Roman Abramovich, who, of course, Chelsea owner until the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. And it's all about payments that were made over several years to managers, scouts, football agents linked to Chelsea. And The Guardian folks in their latest reporting on Marina Granovskaya. She was running Chelsea as CEO, close associate. And this is all about the cash she might receive. And just what did she know about other payments?
This kind of broke initially when UEFA revealed last year that it had agreed a 10 million euro fine with Chelsea because the club's owners, Todd Boehly, had self-reported some irregular payments that had been uncovered by the accountants and auditors going through the books ahead of the takeover. So this is payments that had been made during the Abramovich era. What the leaked documents, the sort of Cyprus files, appear to show is that Marina Granovskaya, who was the person in charge of the transfer policies, that she was sent copies of these agreements for secret offshore payments, so off-the-book payments related to transfers. I mean, I reported last year it was Willian and Samuel Eto'o's moves from Russian club Anzhi, and The Guardian also reported Eden Hazard's transfer that had these irregular payments connected to them. It's quite a big deal for the whole issue, which is still being investigated by the Premier League, by the way, as to if the effective chief executive knew about this. Then that's probably not great news for the club.
Aziz, potentially tip of the iceberg there, because if this is true, and at the moment these are just allegations, you would think, well, why would you do it for two players? So if that's the way the business operates. This is thanks to leaked documents, and you get this, but this might be a wider issue. And the thing I was thinking about, Chelsea not only had Granovskaya there, they're also very embedded at the time within the Premier League. Bruce Buck, the former chairman, was extremely senior official within the Premier League system, wasn't he? He was on very important committees, important boards. And you've got to wonder, how much does he know, or did he know at the time? And it talks about separation of power and how...
Again, I think he...
How do you run these organisations in a way that's fair?
Yeah. I think Bruce Buck and his law firm that he works for have denied any wrongdoing around this. I spoke briefly to Marina Granovskaya earlier this week, and she said she didn't want to comment on this. Bruce Buck, he was chairman of the Premier League's Remuneration Committee, so he was very, very influential, probably the most influential of all the club chairmen in the Premier League. So it's going to be an intriguing when this eventually comes out. And I mean, there is a chance we could see details coming out in a court of law.
What will the consequences be for them with the Premier League? This is a new era at Chelsea. Todd Boehly, Clear Lake Capital. They've apparently been helping in terms of investigations into past issues. Will some see it as unfair as if they are punished for what happened under a previous regime? Or the fact is, if there was any wrongdoing, well, you've got to be punished at some point.
It's really an interesting one, isn't it? I mean, you have to get a lot of mitigation for the fact that you've found this out, you've reported it. On the other hand, it's if you get away without anything, then you can just say there's no deterrent. People saying, "Oh, we'll potentially cheat or go off the books," and then when we sell the club, there'll be no consequences. Because I mean, that surely can't work like that either.
No, it also
would allow you to sell the club to circumvent any potential looming case in a hypothetical scenario involving some club.
Yeah, we're creating quite an architecture of cheating here. But what I was wondering is, doesn't it matter what the scale of this is? You talk about mitigation. If this is like widespread, massive, cheating of the rules. We've talked about Manchester City in the past and 115 charges. But if it's found that it's this enormous Pandora's box that wasn't ever found until this change of ownership, you know, again, you're looking, it just corrupts the idea of what the Premier League is, doesn't it? And the Premier League is not able to find anything out by itself, it seems, as well, if all of this has been happening for the last two decades.
Of course, we say yet to hear the full side of Graniskaya. Also, Saif Ruby, Martin.
Yes, Saif Ruby is a football agent who has been charged with a criminal charge of sending a malicious communication to Marina Granovskaya following the transfer of Kurt Zouma from Chelsea to West Ham. He emailed her saying he was owed some money and was unhappy the fact that it hadn't been paid. Now, the Crown Prosecution Service have confirmed that there is a application going into court for the whole issue around these Chelsea's transfers and irregular payments to be sort of disclosed as part of the court case, as part of effectively to help his defence. So we will find that out in the next week if that's allowed. And I mean, that would be intriguing if Chelsea and Granovskaya then are sort of have to speak about this whole issue in court, and I'm sure the Premier League will be keeping a close eye on that one too. I should add, of course, that Saif Ruby is denying the charge completely.
In other Premier League news, briefly, the profit sustainability cases against Nottingham Forest and Leicester City. So we've got news of an appeal from Forest, and in terms of Leicester, some questioning, is it all attempting to clamp down on ambition?
Yeah, these two cases, Forest, Leicester, and before that, Everton, has really put the focus on these profit sustainability rules. Lots of fans saying they're unfair. But, I mean, they are the rules in place. So I don't think you can complain too much. But, yeah, Forest appealing against a four-point deduction. Leicester City is a really interesting one. So they've basically said that they're going to legally challenge the Premier League and the EFL because or over the jurisdiction, because they were relegated from the Premier League, yet they're still being charged by the Premier League. The EFL have issued them with a transfer embargo, and they're saying that's unfair too because the financial year is still ongoing. So this whole thing is kind of, do you not think it's sort of drifting into the sort of realms of making the lawyers very happy?
Well, always. The lawyers are always happy regardless. But it is, you know, the idea of these rules being so kind of messy probably wasn't envisioned when they drew the papers up. But the question for you, Martin, the Leicester case, the EFL punishments are more codified, aren't they? The sanctions regime, the Premier League one, doesn't have a tariff. If they were sanctioned by the EFL, wouldn't the points be a lot more significant? You know, we saw four with Nottingham Forest and maybe six with Everton. The EFL ones are pretty meaty, aren't they?
Yeah, they do tend to be, as you say, because they're sort of codified. You know what you're going to get. Given the choice, you'd probably prefer to come before a Premier League commission. Leicester would say they shouldn't go beyond either.
Case that will be continuing as the season comes to a conclusion. Let's move on to some UEFA news and some attention on their multi-club ownership rules this week, particularly since the Ineos stake that's been purchased in Manchester United, 27.7%. They also do own Nice, the petrochemicals giant led by Sir Jim Ratcliffe. We still don't know which competitions they'll end up in terms of European qualification, but if they'll both end up in the Europa League, could one of them be banned from playing? And in part, it depends who qualifies as the higher ranked team, don't they? So if United were to win the FA Cup, that might outrank, in terms of Nice's Ligue 1 performance for qualification.
Still very much unknown. And what UEFA have done was clarified that there's one change now, is that if you've got a club in the Champions League and a sister club in the Europa League, then they can both play, because they couldn't before, because they had this thing about a sort of drop down from the Champions League to Europa League. That can't happen anymore. I'm still not convinced that even if they are in the same competition, Nice and Manchester United, that there won't be some sort of arrangement done. I mean, so we saw, didn't we, with the Red Bull clubs, that they both allowed to compete.
They've never done it. They just have never, like UEFA, and we talk about the idea that they're going to say to Manchester United or Manchester City or someone, sorry, lads, yeah, and we know you qualified for the Champions League. You can't, you're not going to go. They'll find a way. You kind of sort of move some deck chairs around, change some paintings, move the coffee table a bit to the left, and yep, you know, you're in, that's fine now. That's what's going to happen.
Maybe in terms of showing different people running the club, ultimately, even if the ownership has the same people right at the top.
Because they're not going to pick the phone up and talk to each other. It's pie in the sky. You know, at the end of the day, they should just come clean and say, we've lost control of multi-club ownership. We can't do anything.
And in Formula One, you have drivers from the same team competing against each other on the grid, although that does throw up often team orders issues.
Imagine that. Champions League final, penalty shootout, team orders.
And we've got the Club World Cup to come from FIFA. We could get multiple teams from the same ownership in the same group or at some point in that competition.
I think you're right, Tarek. The whole multi-club ownership thing has got so sort of out of hand now that it's almost, the rules are certainly, they certainly don't work. And the question is whether it's any point having them.
Something else involving UEFA and the Champions League, that fallout from the 2022 disorder in Paris. Just after we recorded last Friday, UEFA announced they'd concluded a full and final settlement, as they called it, with those Liverpool fans represented by a particular firm. They said the details remain confidential and it was a settlement reached without any admission of liability. Then, at the start of this week, we had another law firm who made their own announcement saying that they understood this settlement was reached only with a small group of fans. And they're claiming that UEFA have made no meaningful efforts to settle the claims we issued 12 months ago on behalf of 1,200 fans. And they question why UEFA are treating different groups of fans who had the same level of mistreatment and harm differently. And they believe the settlement causes division and unnecessary anxiety. They're still pushing towards getting compensation.
Also a private settlement, which both sides agreed that the details won't come out, which is a real shame, given that the importance of transparency here. Yes, there was that report, but even in this case, it's important that the public get to know, I think, what happens. But that's how the law works. Two civil parties can agree the terms of their settlement, and often it is private.
Particularly as UEFA did put out that full report showing all the issues from Paris, and they've been talking about how they will attempt to improve things in future and lessons learned for hosting future finals. Now, as we wrap up things, a few final talking points. We've been so football dominated, but in terms of the IOC, we don't talk about Thomas Bach and his presidency often, but we're still waiting to decide what his future will be running the world of the Olympics.
Yeah, I thought this sort of went under the radar slightly, but I thought it was a very interesting story. It's the IOC Ethics Commission basically has said that no one who wants to be the next IOC president can basically announce it or campaign during the Paris Olympics in the summer. And effectively, Thomas Bach, the decision whether he wants to sort of get the statutes changed or the charter changed so he can run again, or at least try and put that to the vote. That's going to take place after the games and could be by a postal vote, which I think has sort of made some of the potential candidates a bit unhappy, because they think it's sort of easier for people just to say, yes, Thomas Bach, please stay.
I would like to say I'm surprised, but we've seen how power works in these organisations, haven't we? These are the games that are played, whether it's in IOC or any other sports federation. Hard to give up, isn't it?
Yeah, the IOC Ethics Commission said, in relation to the IOC president's decision regarding the election, it is clear the timing of such a decision may create a high risk of overshadowing the Olympic Games, as well as the election campaign itself. Therefore, it is recommended the president postpone any such decision until the end of the Olympic Games. So, yeah. Does that look like a bit of a stitch-up?
Yeah, nice to have an ethics committee that's very familiar to you come out in your favour, I guess.
And it won't stop various manoeuvring in the shadows, behind the scenes. Well, that about brings an end to this week's episode of Sport Unlocked. As ever, if you hit subscribe, we land in your feeds automatically, and you can message us at Sport Unlocked on X, Facebook, and Instagram. For now, thank you for listening, and we look forward to welcoming those IEC candidates in future. Goodbye for now.